March 24th, 2017. At this time, I'd entertain a motion to to approve the minutes. Any additions or corrections? Representative Metza moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are approved. Next, we got a report from the OLA. So if they could come forward, please, at this time. There we are. Okay. Good morning, Chris. All right. Would you introduce yourself for the group, please?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Minnesota Legislative Auditor's Office. I oversee the Financial Audit Division.
Thank you. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, first of all, I'd like to thank everybody for giving us an opportunity to present this morning. The goal of my presentation is to give members of the committee an update on our professional technical service audit. Everybody should have a copy of the audit report in their kit. And in particular, I was asked to provide some insight into the findings in the report that pertain to the Pollution Control Agency. So first of all, to set a little bit of context, for those of you that aren't familiar with the term professional technical service contract, those are contracts that state agencies enter into where we hire a contractor to perform a technical or a professional service. In many cases, they also produce a report as well. It's an important area for us to look at as the auditor's office for several reasons. First of all, I think people are surprised to know that that on an average year, we spend over $400 million a year on professional technical services across state government. But in addition to the materiality of the area, contracts are inherently complex and are difficult for agencies to manage. That's another reason why we think it's important to look at this area. And there's a lot of compliance requirements for professional technical contracts that are rooted in state law. So the scope of this audit did a couple things. First of all, we looked at the oversight that was provided by the Department of Administration, their policies, their standards, the guidance that they give to state agencies for this area. But then we did detailed testing of contracts at the five agencies that have the highest expenditures in the state. Those are the Department of Transportation, Corrections, Human Services, PCA, and the Education Department. One thing to point out is that the scope of our audit did not include IT contracts across the state. IT contracts account for about $125 million more on an annual basis, but this audit did not include oversight of IT contracts. The report was a fairly positive report. We said overall that we felt that that the state had generally adequate controls. The administration department did a fairly good job providing guidance to agencies, policies and standards, and for the most part, we felt that the agencies were following those policies and standards. But we did have three findings in the report with some internal control and compliance issues. And I'm going to talk about all three of those findings because the Pollution Control Agency is named in all three of those. So the first finding in the report dealt exclusively with the Pollution Control Agency. And that dealt with the payment of contractor invoices. We found two issues when we looked at the contracts in the Pollution Control Agency. First of all, we found a very high error rate when we looked at the rates that were being charged to the agency versus the rates in the contract. So 40% of the invoices that we tested, we found that the vendors billed the agency for rates that exceeded the maximum amounts in the contracts. And we also found situations in 50% of the invoices where we found that that the agency paid for services without getting enough information to substantiate the charges on the invoices. So this was an issue that was unique to the Pollution Control Agency. So we did have some very sweeping recommendations in this area. First of all, since we had such high error rates in the contracts that we tested, and we did not test all the contracts in the agency, we recommended that the agency go back and review all of their PT contracts and the invoices to look for other situations beyond the ones that we saw, for situations where they overpaid vendors because they paid rates that were too high, and also to go back and look at items on invoices where they didn't get substantiation for the charges on the invoices. So we're recommending that they go back and do a post-review of those contracts and recollect the money from the vendors where they were, or vendors were overpaid. The second issue in the report impacted three agencies that we reviewed as part of our scope, and this was a contract or a finding that dealt with retainage. And for those of you that aren't familiar, state law has a provision where we withhold a portion of the contract until the end of the contract. There's also provisions where you can withhold portions of every invoice. And the goal of withholding that money or the retainage is to make sure that we have leverage at the end to demand performance if there's issues with the contract. So it's a requirement that's rooted in law, but it's also a really strong control environment to protect the state interests. What we found is that three agencies did not comply with retainage requirements. We found error rates on the contracts ranging from 17% to 30%. The PCA's error rate in particular was 29%. And what we're recommending for this finding is that the agencies simply comply with the retainage requirements that are in law. They're there to protect the state interests. And then finally, our last finding in the report dealt with performance reporting requirements. So in state law, there's requirements where state agencies are required to do reporting to the Department of Administration. And that reporting really serves two purposes. That the reporting that comes in on PT contracts allows the Department of Administration to produce required reports that provides transparency both to legislators and to the public into state contracts. So the information is aggregated by the administration department. It's presented for policymakers to understand what are the contracts that are going on in state government. It also provides information to the public and citizens as well. And along with that performance reporting, with the transparency, it also provides insight into contractors that don't perform, so that if we have issues with one particular contractor, we can find out about contractors that don't perform so that we don't continue to hire them on an ongoing basis. So we found in the five agencies that we looked at error rates on performance reporting that ranged from 75 to 100%. The PCA had 100% error rate, so essentially they were not complying with the legal provisions in law for reporting. So what we're recommending is really two things, that the agencies comply with the law, but because the error rates were so egregious, we also made a recommendation to the Department of Administration that this is one area that was put in state law for a reason, and we recommended the Department of Administration assume a stronger oversight role to follow up with agencies to demand performance as well. Mr. Chair, committee members, I was told to be brief and synopsized today, and that's the high-level view of PT contracting. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions from any members today.
Thank you, Mr. Boozy. And it wasn't me that told you that either. Okay, Representative Uglum, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Busey, very concerned about the error rate at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, 100%. What was their excuse for not following recommended procedure?
Mr. Busey.
Mr. Chair, committee members, there wasn't excuses. I was actually fairly impressed with the responses to in the audit report from all the agencies. The responses essentially say in the report that they just didn't get the job done. All the agencies acknowledged the issues and said that they're going to work harder to improve their internal controls and ensure compliance with the law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Mr. Busey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Busey, now you did in the report mention some of the expenses that were approved over and above. Do you have any idea how much money was not correctly run through the system?
Mr. Boozy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I do not have a precise estimate. That was the recommendation, though, for the agency to go back. We certainly had some costs that we saw based on the sample items that we tested, but part of the audit is only testing a sample of the contracts for the agency as a whole. So rather than recommend that they go back and, you know, collect the X number of thousands of dollars that we identified in the audit, we thought it was more prudent for us to recommend that they go back and look at them all and collect all the money that was overpaid rather than just focusing on the sample items. But that will be something that the agency will have to address.
Representative Jubal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Busey, just to follow up then. So how are we as the legislator who, you know, represents the people that pay the taxes that fund the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, how are we going to be assured that this problem is not going to continue and that possibly we're going to be able to claw back some of this money?
Mr. Busey.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my recommendation to you would be to have a follow-up hearing at a later point in time to look at this specific issue and see the follow-up work that was done by the agency and get the results when they analyze the population as a whole.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Busey. Yep. That sounds like a very good idea.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, who should be looking over these agencies? I mean, we can't expect the governor to be able to pay attention and deal with each commissioner individually and ask if you're properly paying your bills on time and correctly. But do we have a failure at the Department of Administration? You know, in other words, there has to be a mechanism, I would hope here, that if it would have worked, would have brought each one of these agencies up and said, we see a problem, you better stop what you're doing and fixing it. So did you really, were you able to address where that breakdown was within our system? I would hope there's a correcting mechanism there.
Mr. Chair, committee members, when it comes to issues like this, the buck really stops with the agencies to establish contracts that follow state law, the policies and procedures that are put forth. The Department of Administration, they play a role to make sure that we have overall guidance. That's their job in the governance framework. But agencies are responsible for following that guidance, making sure that they do the right thing. There aren't provisions where people go out and examine and do post-audits on most of these contracts. Several agencies have internal audit functions that may be able to perform that kind of role. But that's an important role that we play in the Legislative Auditor's Office. Is we work for you. We are a legislative function, and our job is to be your eyes and ears and to go out and do this kind of spot check work. So there's governance that's built into the processes and the executive branch, but there's also oversight responsibility that rests in the legislative auditor's office as well.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely, and we really appreciate what you do. Unfortunately, it's after the fact. And now we've doubled the amount of work that we have to do when you have to go back and re-invoice and do that type of thing. The other thing is, did you see any signs of accountability within these agencies as to really, you would think that they immediately started trying to correct the problem as you were auditing, but did you see any of that? Are we in a situation where we're now waiting to see what our reaction is to this?
Mr. Busey.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think the responses in the report are pretty important. And that's one thing that I always focus on and what I would encourage policymakers to look at is look at the agency's reaction to the finding. And I think all the agencies that responded to the report took their responsibilities as executive branch leaders pretty seriously. So that's one of the things that was important to me is to look at it. If I see an agency that I feel like they look at the findings and they kind of poo-poo the findings, I think that should be a red flag for all of us. But the fact that the agencies took the findings seriously, you know, they're in the room here today to testify if you'd like them to. I think that shows that they're serious about taking corrective action.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the findings, the one that troubles me is finding 3. And I'm wondering, Mr. Busey, or maybe this is something the agency can answer or when they come up, is there any requirement or any protocol where these things just get posted on their webpage. You know, like here's a contracts page, and you just put the contract up there, and there it's public. I mean, wouldn't that be kind of a simple, reporting, file report with the admin, so either admin puts it up on their page or the agency puts it up, or both of them could put it up, then the public can see. It seems like that wouldn't be that hard. So is there anything in law that requires transparency, Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Boozy. Mr. Chair, committee members, one of the reasons why we looked at this provision is because it is codified in statute, and it puts in place a process where it makes it easy for policymakers to understand contracting across state government. So this process brings the data together. It requires the data to come together. It gives the administration department access to all that information so that they can provide you as legislators information about contracting for state government as a whole. It has different elements that are required to be reported for each contract. So the difference between this being just posted on an agency website, versus being aggregated together, it provides transparency by actually aggregating all of the data statewide. And it includes all the contracts that the state enters into that are above $25,000.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And follow-up, is there a requirement then for the Department of Administration to post everything so it's not just the legislators, but it could be anybody who could look at those and see the transparency? Or does it just say that admin must receive them and have them?
Mr. Boozy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, there is a requirement that these get posted so they're available to both policymakers and to the general public.
Representative Hatton, you're good. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boozy. Is there any history in Minnesota where, in a situation where the terms of a contract have not been fulfilled, that the Minnesota Attorney General gets involved with legal action?
Mr. Boozy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't have specific examples offhand, but there's numerous examples where contract disputes occur between vendors and agencies. Before joining the Legislative Auditor's Office, I came from IT. And I know in the IT world, there's lots of situations like that occur where vendors do not perform, and then there's legal action that happens between the council and agencies and the Attorney General's office. So these kind of situations happen all the time.
Representative Farkelson.
Thank you. That's all.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bussey. I've heard the term clawback some of the money. Re-invoice where we have overpaid on these contracts. Is that happening?
Mr. Boozy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that was our recommendation that be done. It will certainly, looking at the ones where contractors charged us rates that exceeded the amounts in the contract, those will be fairly easy ones for the state to identify. And I didn't use the term claw back, but to go back and recoup some of that money.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Boozy. The way this is worded, and it says all the agencies we examined failed to do the reporting. And so by not doing the reporting, do we not know how the contract was fulfilled? I guess what I'm asking you is, the first question is, on the contracts, were the contracts fulfilled to satisfaction, or did nobody just bother to check at all?
Mr. Boozy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the contracts that we tested, we were not aware of situations where the contracts were not fulfilled to the satisfaction of the agency. The issue on the reporting is that provides that aggregate pool of data that provides transparency into what government is doing in this area. So we're not saying in our finding that the contracts weren't satisfied and there wasn't satisfactory performance by the vendors. We're just saying that the goal of those provisions in law are to provide transparency to help identify potential situations where vendors do not do a good job for the state. So that's the purpose of that provision in law that we're citing in this last finding.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying really is that we don't know because the report work wasn't done. So the next question is, when you looked into these agencies, do you think that the employees there are capable of doing this?
Mr. Boosie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the requirements in law are really simple, so they're certainly capable of doing the reporting.
Representative Green.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's just kind of negligence then on the part of the agency for not doing this 100% of the from 75 to 100% of the time.
Mr. Boosie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the error rates indicate that we have a fairly substantial problem in this area.
Thank you.
Representative Green. Okay. Mr. Bunker from MPCA, would you come down, please? Thank you, Mr. Boosie. Don't go away. I mean, stay close.
Don't leave the building.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Would you introduce yourself for the
Joshua
record?
Joshua Bunker. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, as you've heard, the MPCA was one of five state agencies that were reviewed during this professional technical services contract audit, and the years of coverage for those audits were financial years 15, 16, and then the first 8 months of fiscal year 17, so July through February of 17. The result of the OLA's audit of our professional technical service contracting activities fell into really two large categories. First, they concluded that the MPCA generally selected contractors and executed contracts in accordance with applicable legal requirements, accurately paid for services received, and properly reported expenditures in our state accounting system for our, over that period of time, $77.6 million worth of expenditures. And secondarily, as you heard from Mr. Busey, they identified weaknesses in three areas that they reported as meriting formal findings. These findings are certainly not acceptable for us as far as regular business practice. So you have, as part of today's handouts, our agency response to the OLA's findings. So in the back of the audit report itself, I believe we are the fourth or fifth agency. They're not actually page numbered when it comes to the agency reports themselves, but you will see in the back of the report a January 5th letter with the MPCA logo at the top of it. And in that letter identifies that we are not only committed to fully resolving all the outstanding issues that the OLA has identified, but are committed to developing and providing training for our agency staff who work in these areas on an ongoing basis, and establish internal controls to assure that oversight in the future is accomplished and performance is up to the policy and statutory requirements that we have. Regarding finding one related to invoice approvals, as noted in the audit report itself, four of the 10 sampled identified overpayments for a total of $1,544.
And so we will. Mr. Bunker, would you repeat that, please?
Four of the 10 sampled identified rates that exceeded those within our contracts for a total of $1,544. So those were the overpayment amounts that the legislative auditor noted.
And what was the overall value of the contracts?
The overall value of the contracts over that period of time was $77,600,000. So we will follow up with that contractor, as there was one contractor in question that had the overpayment of rates. There were four invoices related to one contract where that overpayment occurred. We are in the process of speaking with that contractor right now to see if there's any additional documentation from that one contractor plus the others included over that period of time to determine whether there is any additional overpayment. There was a question earlier related to reclaiming dollars, those monies, the $1,544, would be returned then to the environmental fund. Regarding finding two with retainage requirements, we will develop and provide training for contract managers to ensure that no more than 90% of the amount due under professional technical contracts is paid until the contractor has satisfactorily fulfilled all terms of the contract. And the balance due then between the 90% and the 100% will be paid only upon verification of satisfactory completion. I believe during that time, the auditor noted that there were two errors for a total of $1,936. Regarding finding three, we've spoken of with the 100% error rate, that was 5 of 5 tested. Submitting contract reviews to the Department of Administration is what this finding is regarding. There is a requirement that we post on the Department of Administration's website our reviews of contractors. Each agency has a unique password and login to post the results of those contractor reviews for items that are $25,000 and over. We have developed an internal process to ensure compliance with this required contractor performance reporting to the Department of Administration. Since the time of the OLA work, we have discussed our planned process improvement with the Department of Administration, and our completion date for all of these items is targeted for April 30th, a couple months from now in 2018. As mentioned in our response to the OLA's findings, we are committed to ensuring these findings are resolved, and we will train now and regularly train in the future to ensure that these performance areas are not repeated.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. They tested 10 of your contracts. How many total contracts did you have during that period?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to find that number of total contracts during that entire period of the 2.5 fiscal years and get back to you with that.
Representative Green. Contract.
Well, Mr. Chair, well, thank you, but I would have thought you'd had that, seeing as how you were coming here and being under the gun. But basically, if we look at the total number of contracts, you're almost 50% that didn't comply just in the 10. So when you say then that you're going to have you're going to try to satisfy the findings by April 30th, is that just the findings in the report, or are you going to go back and check all of the contracts to see if there was any other errors?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, of the 4 of the 10 were those that were sampled for a total that certainly did not amount to the $77,600,000 over the period of the audit itself. We are going to immediately review the activities under those 10 contracts to ensure that that is in place, and then begin a longer and broader process to review practices across the agency and results under other contracts.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, well, that doesn't really answer my question, because, yeah, there's 10 contracts that you that nearly half of them had errors in them, and you're looking at what is probably a small amount for that, but it's still errors. But it doesn't answer the question of out of all the contracts. I mean, did you have a little over 10 contracts in 2.5 years, or did you have multiple more than that? So if for instance you had 2,500 contracts, that would mean that according to this, nearly half of those 2,500 may have errors. If you're looking at percentages. So what I'm asking you is not just are you going to look forward in the future, you're going to go back and review those contracts for errors.
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as mentioned, certainly with a sample of 10, we will be looking at those 10 immediately, and we will continue to follow up with those contracts that we have executed in the past to determine whether or not there are continuous issues and performance management challenges across the board.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, can you just give me a straight answer? Are you going to go back and look at those other contracts?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. We are going to go
Thank
back
you.
And look at those other contracts.
Representative Hugo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on Representative Green's line of questioning here, which I was thinking about, too. You know, 40% error rate on each contract, $77 million worth of contracts in the period that we're talking about. And I guess my question is, and I'm glad to see that you've committed that you're going to go back and review all of those contracts for mispayments, and I would imagine we'll be having another hearing on that. But, Mr. Bunker, do you have any idea? So this is a 40% error rate during the period that the OLA looked at. Do you have any idea how long this could have been going on? Could it have been going on last year, and the year before this, and the year before that? Do you have any idea? Do you know?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not.
So in truth, thank you, Mr. Chair. So in truth, if we have a 40% error rate on the sampling of invoices that the OLA did, on invoices of $77 million, that could be multiplied many, many times more, possibly in the past. Is that correct?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I won't have that information until we finish the review.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, this is a very serious problem, and to gloss over the fact that, well, there's $1,544 in payments, this is only the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, we sit here, we're representatives of the people, and we have to do our job. And this is part of our job, oversight of the agencies and things, and thank God the OLA is around to do this. We have many systemic problems. I sit on state government finance, and we have many problems with monies being allocated and spent that are not correct. So I would hope that you would take this seriously and go back with a fine-tooth comb, not just this last year, but other years too, and see how long this possibly could have been going on. Thank you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question that I think Representative Uglum may have addressed, and I guess I would, continuing on that line of questioning, just ask, why does MPCA impose fines when they find mistakes in the public?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer to our legislative director.
Identify yourself for the record, please, Ms. Gauthier, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I don't understand. I'm sorry. Can you give me more explanation?
Well, I have. Representative Heintzman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's a number of businesses in my community that have made mistakes, and they wound up with a number of different fines for making those mistakes. And I'm wondering, there's a reason, because we're hoping for compliance is the idea, I think, behind a fine. What does the agency have in mind in terms of policing themselves? What should the process be if we have a period of 3 years, and it maybe very well could go back further yet, of there being issues in terms of contracts and following state law? What should there be in terms of penalties for those kinds of errors?
Ms. Gauthier.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think I understand your question, Representative Heintzman. You're talking about our enforcement activities as opposed to our contracting activities, because this report only covers our contracting activities with professional and technical assistance. And I'd be happy to get more information about that, but I did not come prepared today to talk about our enforcement activities. I will say that we do sign a contract every other year with the United States EPA to enforce federal law in the state of Minnesota for them, and we also have authority in Minnesota statutes to enforce the laws that are on the books in Minnesota. So beyond that, without knowing, I'd be happy to meet with you offline about your particular constituents, and I'd be happy to come back at another time to talk about our enforcement activities, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry I don't have that information with me.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I appreciate the offer to meet offline, but the point I'm trying to make is simply that when folks across the state of Minnesota, when businesses make mistakes, there are some pretty significant penalties that they incur. And here I think we have a number of examples, just in a very small sample, of significant mistakes being made at a high level. And it sounded like these are things that are not complex concepts, whether holding back dollars in a contract to ensure that those contracts are satisfied. It doesn't make any sense how that could just be a simple oversight, and we're going to go back and we're going to fix that. Well, that's fine, but I don't understand why those kinds of simple procedures and statute aren't being followed, and would you have any recommendations to the legislatures how maybe that could be what could we do to help prevent that happening again?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very sorry, but I don't understand the question, but I would be happy to come back and talk about enforcement.
Fine. I think I made my point.
Thank you. Representative Bliss.
Thank you. And I'm going to follow up with what Representative Heitzman was saying. In my private life, I run a small business, and when my vendors send me an invoice, I check those invoices. As a chief information officer for a large corporation, I handled multi-million-dollar contracts. I did the same thing. If I would have turned in invoices to my accounts payable and approved them, I would have been called on the carpet and hopefully just been reprimanded and possibly been fired. My question is, what kind of repercussions are the employees that approve these overcharges and non-compliance issues? What kind of disciplinary actions are there going to be for those people?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in our process of going through follow-up on this item itself, we're determining whether or not this is a pattern of behavior on an individual or individuals, and if it is an individual that continues to carry out their duties in a way that is not sufficient to accomplish the required duties in these transactions, then there'd be performance management repercussions.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you, Chairman. Again, I didn't approve every invoice that came up for my ultimate approval. I had multiple levels below me that approved. But I, as a director or vice president level, I had ultimate authority. And if my staff would have approved something that went through my desk, it would have been my butt. It sounds like you're going back and kind of putting it on the people. There should have been ultimate an ultimate authority level above the people below. And I want to, it just sounds like this is systemic throughout government right now. And I just don't want it to be brushed under the carpet. Oh, we're going to do training in the future. There needs to be repercussions. These are some serious allegations for taxpayer money. And I know that you keep mentioning just $4 of the $10 and $1,500, but if you go back and as Representative Green, you know, I'm sure there's hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of contracts. And if you multiply that 40% over that, you're going to get some serious cash. And I just want to see some repercussions and some penalties addressed. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fudzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could be, I think, maybe directed at Mr. Bunger, but just looking at, so if you could analyze not just the contract and the way it was put out, but, like, was there any correlating factors? Like, I'm thinking, is there two different types of systems that maybe were within the agencies? Like, if you had a short-term contract, they were treated in a certain way, or potentially a long-term contract. I think it was, I forget who asked the question about past, that they're going to be looking at a clawback and looking at back contracts. Are there long-term contracts that are still in existence that would be maybe continuing for the next few years? That would be maybe something to look at first if they were properly taken care of, and then also, you know, was long-term contracts treated different than short-term contracts when it came to, you know, the proper channels here, just to see if there's a little bit of a system or a breakdown.
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, all contracts should go through a similar verification and payment process. Whether or not the contracts within this audit are long-term, as in still in place right now, and then an amount would be balanced out, a shortage of a future payment, that I can't say at this time.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for some of the earlier questions, we do have our Director of Operations here who could speak to our performance management system. I believe there was a question from Representative Bliss about that as to whether or not there is performance management follow-up when employees make errors. If you would like that, we can have her come up and speak.
Yeah. Sure. Quickly. Representative Hansen.
On this point, I think both as legislators and the executive, we have to be careful of not drawing conclusions or providing conjecture on individual persons' performance. You know, the protection of their due process of whether they did or did something wrong. So I would hope that, you know, I would hate to think there's employees in every agency thinking here we are in the legislature making a conclusion based on their work without evidence. So I hope in this conversation that we, you know, if management has made an error, like not doing the reporting, I think that that's clearly a thing. But I'm cautious about saying things are systemic or broad if we don't have the evidence. If in this testimony, if we say there's been enforced or compliance action or something taken, and I'm not sure I know the right way to do this, but I think if there's investigations going on or whatever, that we just try to talk about what we know and what's going on rather than drawing a broad brush conclusion, not only on one employee, but for all state employees.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to turn the conversation back to concerns that Representative Heitzman brought up about some of these contractors and vendors that are, some of these contractors and vendors that are actually benefiting by possible overpayments and that type of thing. And I know the Department of Labor has a list of vendors that are deemed unacceptable to do business with the state of Minnesota. And I would like to know if any of these vendors that have been identified through the audits have ever been banned from doing business with the state.
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the contracts in question all went through a review of whether the vendor was debarred or suspended. At the time, and none of the and we don't check either far earlier or after the fact for any of those vendors. Just at the time we're looking to engage them, that they are not included within a state debarred or suspended list.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have knowledge of any actions that the MPCA has taken to ban any vendor in recent history?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of any instances. Instead, we typically rely upon the Department of Labor and others who populate that debarred and suspended list for their determination.
Okay. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concerns are with the people that are benefiting financially from these oversights. Thank you.
Representative Bliss, would you like to re-ask your question?
Sure. And I just want to respond to the comment made earlier. I understand painting a broad brush, but there are names associated with approval of these invoices, and those people were derelict in their duties, and it's taxpayer money, and we have a duty to our constituents to watch over that. And my question to the testifiers is there a policy in place for disciplinary action against the employees that did not follow policy?
To the testifiers, please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Rena Solhide with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm the Operations Division Director. And to answer the question for the representative, regarding the state's performance management system, absolutely. We do have a process to ensure that the employees, regarding their knowledge, skills, and abilities, are held accountable for performing their duties to the utmost of being able to do them. And when there are errors that are found in their performance, there is a process to address those concerns up to including discipline that can include termination. So we are very much committed to what Mr. Bunker has said, to these findings, to address them, to correct them. And as the Operations Division Director, we are taking this very seriously. We do not expect any of our employees to be derelict in their duties. Unfortunately, these findings indicate that we have some areas for improvement, and we are fully committed to addressing those areas so that we are in full compliance.
Thank you. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question. This goes back to finding number one. I just want to make sure I'm understanding it properly. What I was hearing is that there was $1,544 of overpayments, and if I understood right, that was $1,544 of overpayments on $77 million worth of contracts?
No. Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Bunker. Chair, Representative, that was the amount that was noted by the auditor as overpaid from the sample of in four of the 10 cases of the sample.
Representative Fisher.
So what I'm trying to get at is, what was the in the sample there were 10 contracts that were looked at. Four of them had errors.
Mr. Bunker.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Representative Fisher.
In those 10 samples, what was the value of the total value of the contracts in those 10 samples?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I need to correct my last statement. The audit itself says for one contract, four of 10 invoices tested had hourly rates that exceeded amounts permitted. So that was four of 10 on one large contract.
Representative Fisher.
And what was the value of the total contract?
Mr. Bunker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have that total amount of that individual contract.
Representative Green.
I think we're probably about ready to wrap up, I would think. So I just wanted to bring this up. 100% noncompliance is not even trying. I mean, 75% is bad enough in the Department of Corrections. That's dismal. But 100% is not even trying. And Mr. Buzzy testified that this is law, that you have to do this. And so this is something that I've seen in other agencies, too. It's like the agencies believe they're above the law, and that they can go out and, as Representative Heinzman said, they can fee and fine and demand and even drive people off their own property if they so choose. But if they don't even try to obey the law, oh, well, we'll go back and fix it. No big deal. And we'll look into it. And it's really tiresome, and I hope we can deal with this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Becker, quickly, please.
Yeah, one quick comment. The concerns I have is, we have 3 years of errors with invoices. As a business owner, if I did that with my merchant account with Master Visa Discover, I would have chargebacks. I would have been removed of my merchant agreement. I would have been reported on ripoffreport.com and BBB. One thing that has been said that concerns me is, I get this sense that you guys want grace, and I can understand that error is too human, but my constituents, every time they talk to me about MPCA, there is no grace on the other side. It's your way or the highway. So it's just that arrogance that concerns me. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn, quickly, please.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, and maybe Ms. Gauthier can answer this question, but during the years that this audit was going on, did MPCA receive the full amount of their funding requests?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Becker Finn, so that would be the fiscal 15-16 biennium. I do not. 14, 15, 16, 17. That'd be a couple of biennia. I know for 18, 19, I don't. Do you know? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I do believe that we may not have, but only a small percent of our budget comes from the general fund. So I'm sorry. I would have to get that for you. I will.
Thank you. Yep. Okay, next up, we have got world-class shooting range site report.
feel free to identify yourselves for the record and start with the presentation.
Mr. Chair, Colonel Rodman Smith, Division Director for the Department of Natural Resources Division of Enforcement. With me today, I have a few people.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Lorena DeWalt. I'm with KLJ. I'm a professional engineer.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Nikki Walenta. I'm with KLJ as well. I'm an environmental planner.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, members, this is the report on the world-class shooting range site. So per laws of 2017, Chapter 93, the department was instructed to contract with a private entity to do a search site for a world-class shooting range and clubhouse for use of the Minnesota High School League and other regional, statewide, national, international shooting competitions. It was supposed to be in the seven-county metro area or outside that area if there was a major thoroughfare that provided easy accessibility back and forth. So prior to the RFP, the DNR did meet with interested stakeholders to kind of form that RFP. We wrote the RFP, put it out, and I'm happy to say that KLJ was awarded that RFP. And so today, Ms. DeWalt will go through that report.
Thank you. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Lorena DeWalt. I'm a professional engineer with KLJ in St. Paul. Thank you again for the opportunity to come today and speak to you to deliver this report on behalf of the DNR. I know most of you are familiar with this project, as there's some history to it, but I'd like to, for the record, just do a brief history for your reference. As many of you know, the process to identify this world-class, to identify a site to build this world-class shooting range in the Twin Cities Metro began with the late Representative David Dill and his passion for outdoor recreation. He and his son Drake traveled all over the United States to attend shooting sports competitions. Their love of these competitions is really what started to fuel the original vision for this project. A parallel vision for this project was also born about 15 years ago with Jim Sable. At the time, Jim began mentoring a small group of students in Orono. As a leader of the Plymouth Gun Club at the time, he had the idea to take that group of students to the local trap range and teach them how to hit targets and engage them in outdoor sports, a sport that was on the decline at the time. When what started years ago as a small group of students looking for a mentor has grown into a national sport today with over 11,000 participants in the state of Minnesota alone. When the league started, local ranges were closing. The sport was on the decline. Now we're seeing the other end of the spectrum where local ranges are booming. They're exceeding capacity, so much so that kids who are interested in the sport are being turned away from local ranges. There's not enough capacity to accommodate them. This year, the first national competition is being held in Michigan because, frankly, there isn't a facility in Minnesota that can accommodate a competition of that size. It's a shame that these kids are being turned away, and it's also a shame that the first national competition is being held in Michigan when it all started here in Minnesota. As the sport began to grow and the need for additional facilities was becoming apparent, several studies were completed to begin exploring ways to meet those needs. I do have a brief PowerPoint that I was going to go through here that was sitting on the screen most of the morning, as you saw, but now we're having difficulties. You have it in front of you.
The other thing you can do is just point out the pages you're going to be on, and we'll follow along.
That's perfect. You have it all. Each of you have it in front of you, so I will start on the slide that says previous studies, this one here. So the previous reports that were done, that started in 2005, the DNR contracted with Responsive Management to do a report to assist in determining the best location and features of ranges and clubs in the metro, intended to inform decisions and help allocate public resources. The study included focus groups and surveys with hunters and firearm safety instructors. In 2009, DNR also engaged with Architectural Resources Incorporated to complete a report illustrating conceptual plan design. So what would a facility of this type, a world-class shooting range facility, what would that look like? What was identified was conceptual plans that ranged from a few hundred, several hundred acres to up to over 1,000 acres. And then lastly, in 2010, DNR published a request for information to determine interest in and obtain information from public and private entities who are interested in helping research a site of this kind. Originally, it was identified to look in the seven-county metro area, As you know, several hundred acres to over 1,000 acres in the Seven County metro area is hard to find. Land is at a premium here, and so with this current report, we've expanded the scope to look at the first and second tier counties of 15 counties. All three of these reports that I've referenced are in the full reports that you have and also online on the committee website. So the next page says 2018 site investigation process. This is the next step in the project process that came last year when your committee helped to appropriate funds in the amount of $30,000 from the Game and Fish Fund to hire an outside consultant, which became us, for the preparation of this report. We were hired last fall, and our team has spent the last few months investigating and compiling data. Originally, like I said, the scope was for the report to search and investigate the 7-county metro, and we expanded that to search in the 15-county metro area. We began our process with data review, agency coordination, communication, and community engagement. We took part in several news articles, Star Tribune, Outdoor News, and a radio interview on the Big Wild. As soon as media outlets were engaged, we started hearing from the public. We started getting calls from local interested parties, vocalizing support, giving us ideas for sites to research. And at the same time, we began reaching out to county staff and planners in the 15-county metro to discuss the potential project and inquire about available land, permitting, and zoning issues as well. We had meetings and discussions with all 15 counties. Some counties were very supportive of the project. Some even came to the table with ideas for where we could put a facility of this type. Some counties vocalized precedent-setting opposition to similar projects or to other development types, and said that if we were to pursue something in their county, we would have to expect some challenges. As we had these conversations and followed up with interested parties and landowners, we began to assimilate the information and compile the data for the report. Our goal was to provide a list of potential sites identified during the high-level investigation, and then offer a recommendation for sites that we felt warranted further investigation, that we thought had enough feasibility and balancing constraints or challenges that could be anticipated to continue the investigation. In the report, we have listed our top 10 sites based on common criteria. We looked at size and location, local infrastructure, adjacent or compatible uses, and potential support or opposition, and then also availability or land acquisition potential. The next page gives a map overview of our top 10 listed sites. And then in this presentation, we highlighted our top four. The first site is the Caribou Gun Club in Le Sueur County. All of these sites are close to meeting or exceed the original identified size in the ARI report of the conceptual designs. Caribou Gun Club property is approximately 750 acres, meets the minimum acreage. There's adequate transportation infrastructure. Each of these sites are also about an hour from Minneapolis-St. Paul. Each of these sites also have the common compatible use benefit, where most of the adjacent uses are rural in nature. There's some scattered residential development and agricultural operations, but three of these sites are also currently being used as either shooting range, they're a gun club, or a game bird range. And some of these sites are also open to partial donation. So I know that we're running short on time, so I wanted to be very brief. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present this report. Mr. Chair and committee members, I would welcome any questions that you have for us.
Thank you. Representative Hockey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I'd like to apologize to the chair and the committee for being late. If you ask me how my day is going, have you ever had a day where your Labrador ate your bananas? That's how my day is going. So thought that'd be funnier. I have a question for you about this. Are any of these sites, has there been any talk of also having a rifle range so people could go sight in rifles and or just general shooting?
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The conceptual designs for this site include all of those. It includes trap ranges, skeet ranges, sporting clays, rifle, pistol. The conceptual designs, which you can see in the full report, there's concepts ranging from several hundred acres to over 1,000 that include all of those things. Some of them include campgrounds and event centers and clubhouses, playgrounds, all of that. So the intent is to was to provide as much high-level information as possible to accommodate a site that would have everything that we would want.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. The one I really like the fact that you're looking at the other gun clubs, and the gun clubs are okay with incorporating this into their organizations. Because it seems like a good fit.
Ms. Walt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Yes, so there is a range of responses or interest. I would say the top clubs that we've listed are very amenable to the project. There are some existing clubs out there who are concerned that this would provide competition for their clubs, regardless of the fact that all the clubs are bursting at the seams right now. So I think there's plenty of business to go around. They see it as competition. Most of the gun clubs are very supportive, and they see that this is supporting the sport as a whole and the future of the sport.
Representative Green.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that they would probably be surprised to find out that it would enhance their business as opposed to that. But have you looked at, there is quite a bit of state-owned land already. Did you look at the land that the state already has in its possession?
Mr. Walden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We started down that process. On the peripheral, we didn't identify originally to go down because the state owns so much land. What we did use in our investigation process was we looked at land that was brought to us or that was put on the table by various counties, and then we looked at where does the state own land around those sites. Is there land that the state owns that could be used as buffer area that could be thought of as buffer area by local residents or by local developments? Some land that was owned by the state that we did look at is detailed in the report, and we think that would be a great idea to move forward to look at some of that state-owned land. There wasn't enough time and scope to go through detailed conversations with the state on those options.
Representative Green.
Only one more.
Robert?
You've got, it says in here that you contacted local government agencies, the counties and cities, but not townships. Now, if you live in Minnesota and you don't live in a city, you live in a township. So is there any reason you excluded townships?
Mr. Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Yes, I would say that the top reason is it was time. We tried to give as much detailed information and as detailed investigation as possible while still keeping it at a high level and giving as many options geographical area as possible. When you start reaching out to all the townships, we just didn't have enough time or money in the budget, to be frank, to be able to address that. Moving forward, we would love to be able to accommodate that, and I think that may be where we need to go with the project is on a deeper dive. And then once we do that, then you start talking to local cities, counties, townships about the specific project you want to bring to their community and actually understand more the constraints, the permitting, the zoning, and the approval process that would need to occur.
Thank you.
Representative Green is going back to his roots when he asked those township questions. Mr. Smith, I'm going to ask you after a while, and you can think a little bit, what's going to be the next steps for DNR in this whole process? But Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of also, I mean, I've been hearing a lot from my local area. There's more and more young interest in, like, three-gun shooting. And I think that's probably the next expansion of this. As, you know, the trap shooting gets going, there's also other that three-gun. Would these sites all potentially work in that particular sport?
Mr. Walt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think that anything is on the table now, Representative. I think that we're really at this point looking for potential land that would be viable or feasible in terms of size, location, support or opposition. And so as far as what this facility would look like, all options are still on the table. I think that we would try to accommodate the demand that's there and then plan for the future as well.
Representative Swedzinski? You didn't want to explain three-gun? Okay, Representative Sundin, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I was really excited about a year ago when a gun club opened up near my house and the one, you know, 20 miles away that I had to drive to. But the excitement fell off very rapidly when I got there, and the only ammunition you could use on that site was the ammunition that they sold you. You could not bring this in. So I'm just wondering about the management and operations of such a facility. Who and how is this going to be regulated on who can bring ammunition in? Because weapons are much good if you're used to using your bullets, your loads, and you're compelled to buy something other than that. It's futile to even work with your rifles on this facility. Can you comment on that,
Director Smith? I see you moving forward.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I can answer your question along with the representative's question. So these next steps with this report is to really work with legislative leadership, legislators, interested stakeholders, and find out where we want to go. Who's going to run this facility? How is it going to be funded? Where are we going to put it? I mean, there's a lot of questions that are unanswered, and I think through Ms. DeWalt's presentation, you can see this goes back to 2005, where this idea has been kind of maturing over time. And so I agree wholeheartedly that if we're going to have some type of world-class shooting range, people want to reload and they want to shoot their own ammo, right? And so, I mean, those are some of those questions that we need to answer. So moving forward, really, is what we need to do is work, like I said, with legislative leaders and find out really what the direction is and start figuring out who's going to run this, how's it going to get paid for, where we're going to site it and whatnot. And I think there's a lot of support here. As Ms. DeWalt said, trap shooting in high school has just exploded. We're turning away kids in some school districts because of capacity. The legislature did give DNR about $2 million of game and fish money to do grants to local gun ranges to expand their capacity for trap ranges. We've gone through about three or four rounds now of that. And we got about $300,000 left, so we'll be doing another round to try to spend that money down. But there is a capacity, there is a need out there for people to shoot. The legislature has addressed that with some of those local clubs, but moving forward really is that conversation. So,
Representative Sundin, follow up. You're good. Okay. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Colonel Smith, I think it was good to hear you give the answer you gave to Representative Sundin's question, because I think that's why people want to go there. They want to shoot the load that they want to shoot and sight in their rifle at whatever distance they want to sight it in. But, Mr. Chair, members, I wanted to support what Representative Green said. I think if we can find a piece of state land, I don't care if we put it on state or private land, but even if it's on private land and we have state land around it to use as a buffer, you know, the more the better. I think this is going to be it's a good idea and a great facility. And the other thing Representative Green said that I think is right on, I don't think this is going to be a threat to the existing hunting clubs, shooting clubs, whatever you call it. I think this will be an enhancement and will probably result in more business for these folks. So thank you for doing what you're doing. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Hanson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the study, you know, was there any analysis on security? Double doors, control of access, chain of custody, protections relating to firearms. Was any of that included in the study?
Mr. Walt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This report, really the intent was to start the site investigation at a high-level feasibility for locations only. So knowing that that's going to be a very important discussion to have, that will be later on when we start discussing the actual location, where this may be, the operations and maintenance, like Director Smith mentioned, something that we would not try to address in this report now.
Representative Hanson. Okay.
I think that's it. Thank you all for your testimony, and we look forward to continuing this conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And we'll get you a new chair, too, there, Colonel.
Thank you.
He didn't vote for it, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's right. Minnows, here we go. Swim on down. Come on.
And there's a big report on this.
I heard someone say they're not going to take the bait on this one here, so I'm not sure what that meant. Good morning. Okay. I'm sorry. All right. Thank you for being here. Look forward to your report. And please identify yourselves for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Ann Pierce. I'm section manager with the Department of Natural Resources with the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. And I'm going to let the gentleman sitting to my left introduce himself, and then we'll get into the report.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Jeff Gunderson, and I'm a consultant.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The laws of Minnesota 2017 directed the Department of Natural Resources to submit a report regarding the potential risk of importing golden shiner minnows into Minnesota. And so in your packet, you should have this brief overview document plus the report. And the report has a cover letter, an executive summary, and then the detailed analysis report is the rest of the report. The DNR, to meet this direction, we worked with the University of Minnesota. We identified three risk assessment experts at the University of Minnesota to help us develop a request for proposals and to also continue to help us with review throughout the process of the development of the report. In addition to those risk assessment experts, we identified a pathogen expert at the University of Minnesota to participate in the development of the report and to help us review that also. The DNR granted the contract to Mr. Gunderson, who is a retired director of the University of Minnesota Sea Grant Program, to develop the report. And the report commissioned ultimately to analyze the risk of pathogen and invasive species that could be introduced to Minnesota via golden shiner importation from Arkansas. Mr. Gunderson reviewed available literature and interviewed experts in Arkansas and other states to evaluate the risk of 33 pathogens and invasive species that could come to Minnesota via golden shiner importation from Arkansas. Through this risk screening process, Mr. Gunderson identified five species that are relatively higher risk with the Arkansas bait certification program in place. And so I will hand it over to Mr. Gunderson to walk through kind of a high level of the report that he developed and then and come back and talk a little bit more. Thank you.
Walk through slow, Mr. Gunderson. I'm a track coach. So,
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to describe the minnow report that that I worked on. First, I'd like to give you a little of my background, which I hope will give you some context for my interest in putting this report together. I retired from the University of Minnesota Sea Grant Program almost 3 years ago, where I worked for 36 years. For those of you not familiar with Sea Grant, it is a federal-state partnership focused on research, technology transfer, and education in a non-advocacy approach. During my time at Sea Grant, I was involved in seafood safety, fisheries, aquaculture, and invasive species, outreach, education, and research. I helped develop the Aquatic Invasive Species Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point curriculum that would help reduce the risk of moving invasive species with bait fish and other activities. So I have had experience with invasive species, aquaculture, and bait fish in the past. I saw my role in putting this report together similar to my non-advocacy role during my career. I'm not here to advocate one way or the other regarding importation of golden shiners. I just put the best unbiased information I could in the time I had available so that you and others could make a more informed decision. I want you to know that there was no undue influence placed on me by Minnesota DNR, Minnesota bait fish dealers, either those supporting this issue or opposed to it, or anybody from the Arkansas industry. Because the risks are a bit nuanced, and I know we have...
Mr. Henderson, can I ask you one quick question here? You said with the time that you had available, I'm just curious to know, was that time, in your opinion, the correct amount of time to do a thorough analysis of what you were doing?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was enough time to accomplish what I needed to accomplish to identify the invasive species of importance. I did identify a number of other research efforts that are needed, I think, to complete this process to be able to make the best decision possible.
And does your report contain those recommendations?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does.
Thank you. We'll get to that.
And so I just wanted to focus, because the risks are a bit nuanced and not clear-cut, I want to make a few comments about the five organisms that I did identify as posing a moderate or elevated risk to Minnesota waters. First, the Asian tapeworm is a parasite that originated in East Asia. The Asian tapeworm can have detrimental effects on fish, including damage to the intestinal tract, reduced growth, and death. Little information is available on the impacts of Asian tapeworm in wild populations. However, Michigan researchers suggest that they may negatively impact wild forage populations. Asian tapeworms are fairly common in Arkansas and have been found on farm-raised golden shiners. While some farms are certified free of Asian tapeworms, other farms in Arkansas are not certified free of Asian tapeworms. I believe the risks can be minimized by requesting that imported golden shiners be certified free of Asian tapeworms and then verify it by selective testing of golden shiners brought into the state. Another parasite is the ovarian parasite. The ovarian parasite is one that infects the ovaries and can cause sterility in farm-raised golden shiners. It is widespread in golden shiner farms around the country, and all Arkansas golden shiner farms are infected with this parasite. It has also been found in golden shiners collected in Minnesota bait shops. However, we don't know the distribution of the parasite in Minnesota. It is found to be widely established in golden shiners raised in Minnesota. If it has been found to be widely established in golden shiners raised in Minnesota, then the risk of bringing it into the state with Arkansas-raised golden shiners would be minimal. Additionally, even though the parasite is widely distributed in farm-raised fish around the country, I could find only one incident where the parasite had been found in the wild, and that was in Oklahoma back in the 70s. And this is considering that, you know, golden shiners have been shipped coast to coast for over 40 years. And that may just indicate that nobody is looking for it either, but it has not been found to be detrimental in wild populations. So even if farm-raised bait are infected, it might not be as be a risk to wild populations. There is no way to control the parasite in Arkansas farm golden shiners. It can even infect away eggs of golden shiner. It can even infect eggs of golden shiners. So I think it's really important to look at the research on this and determine what the distribution is in Minnesota before moving forward with this. Golden shiner virus has been found in golden shiners, fathead minnows, muskies, and some other fish. The pathogenicity of golden shiner virus is not well understood, and opinions vary. Some experts suggest that golden shiner, that it has never caused mortality in golden shiners or other fish. It might be detected in fish that are found in fish kills, but it is not the cause of death. Other experts have seen mortality in muskies raised in hatcheries that they attribute to this virus. The distribution of this virus in the wild in Minnesota is unknown, but it was found in golden shiners collected from Minnesota bait shops. Like Asian tapeworms, the Arkansas certification program will certify shiners as free of golden shiner virus, but because it is found on some farms in Arkansas and there may be a risk to muskies, at least in hatcheries, I elevated this to an organism to look at more closely. And like the ovarian parasite, if golden shiners raised in Minnesota already carry the virus, then it would not increase the risk from this virus to bring them Arkansas Golden Shiners into the state. To minimize the risk, the state could require Golden Shiner free certification and then verify it through their own testing. I could find no information that the virus causes problems in wild fish. So, like the ovarian parasite, it might not cause problems in wild fish. Obviously, more research is needed. The western mosquito fish are native to the Mississippi River and its tributaries from southern Indiana and Illinois to the Gulf Coast. They are a hardy species and have been spread to many parts of the world through introductions attempting to control mosquitoes, even though they are not shown to be effective. Mosquito fish are not thought to be cold tolerant and unlikely to become established in northern states by some sources. However, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ecological screening summary concluded that mosquito fish are invasive and that they could become established anywhere in the continental U.S. So based on that assessment, the fact that they are a prohibited species in Minnesota and they are occasionally found on farms in Arkansas, I elevated the risk level to the state. Big fish farmers that are under the Arkansas certification program must apply best management practices to prevent mosquito fish from getting into their ponds to be part of the certification program. But it can happen. If it happens, fish farmers immediately quarantine and then drain ponds. If there happen to be market-sized golden shiners in those ponds, they may be shipped to states like Texas that don't have restrictions on mosquito fish. Sources have told me that the farmers are work very hard to prevent mosquito fish from getting into states that prohibit them. The last group that I looked at was non-native crayfish. There are two species. The most likely crayfish to be found in baitfish production ponds is the White River crayfish. But I was told that we could not rule out the possibility that red swamp crayfish could be found as well. The overall environmental risk for White River crayfish is unknown, and they're not necessarily considered invasive. The environmental risk posed by red swamp crayfish, however, is considered high, and they are a prohibited species in Minnesota. Even though White River crayfish are the most common crayfish seen and are not considered as invasive as red swamp crayfish, I considered their presence in Golden Shiner shipments a risk in Minnesota. I have heard several reports that crayfish have been found in shipments of Golden Shiners, mostly White River crayfish, so they need to be dealt with. There are at least five different opportunities to reduce the risk of non-native crayfish getting into Minnesota waters. Most of these rely on visual observation and removal. Crayfish can be removed during the farm grading and loading process, loading the trucks in Arkansas. And typically what happens when they bring Arkansas shiners into Wisconsin, they'll offload them at a facility and then grade them again and then haul them to the retail outlets. That is another opportunity where crayfish could be observed and removed from the bait. Also, when they get to the retail outlets, the retail dealers can be trained to remove, and I think they are aware that they should be removing unwanted species. And finally, the angler is the final product, and educated anglers can help prevent the introduction of crayfish as well. And finally, the risk of crayfish is greatly reduced during the winter months, and so if there was some restriction on bringing crayfish, golden shiners into Minnesota to the winter months, that could eliminate that risk. And that is a time when there's a very high market demand for the fishes too, as well. In summary, that is a brief overview of the five organisms I considered that deserve more scrutiny regarding the risk posed to Minnesota. The risks are not clear-cut, and to better evaluate the risk, more information is needed. I've identified several research efforts that would help refine the risks posed by these organisms. Now, I'd just like to add that I was really impressed with how well the industry worked with the university and worked with the regulating the state agencies down there. It was really great to see. So thanks for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. And, Mr. Chair, I believe Ms. Pierce has another comment.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'll just wrap up a little bit. So based on the risks that
Mr. Gunderson kind of briefly outlined here and are outlined in more detail in his report. Number one, that the Arkansas importated golden shiners cannot be certified for all pathogens and invasive species. And in addition, that Arkansas certification program does not mitigate for all the risk of some of these species. That mitigation, that additional mitigation, would fall to the state of Minnesota. And thirdly, because of the issue of chain of custody, so verification between Arkansas and Minnesota and what's happening to those species in between those, the Minnesota DNR recommends that we do not allow importation of golden shiners. However, as outlined in Mr. Gunderson's report, an alternative would be to invest in golden shiner culture in Minnesota. This could provide an opportunity to invest in Minnesota's own industry and to maintain our current protection, which would not open up a new avenue of invasive species into Minnesota. Thank you, and we can take any questions if you'd like.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I guess, Mr. Gunderson, thank you for this report. Did I hear you correctly? I believe you made the comment that golden shiners have been shipped coast to coast for 40 years. Did I understand that that's what you said earlier?
Mr. Gunderson.
Representative and Mr. Chair, the golden shiner, Arkansas is the leading producer of golden shiners in the U.S., and they ship all over the nation and are used for bait fish in the majority, almost all the states, except Minnesota and a couple other states possibly.
Could you be more specific on, do they ship to Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota?
Mr. Gunderson.
Representative, Mr. Chair, they definitely ship to Iowa, Wisconsin. I believe they do as well to South Dakota and North Dakota. I'm not clear on that.
One more follow-up. Did you have an opportunity to look at the provisions that Wisconsin and these other states that share our climate and pretty much fish biology as to how they deal with those potential invasive species? In other words, are they just felony stupid or are we just out of step with everybody else?
Mr. Gunderson.
Representative.
Have at it.
Mr. Chair. It's very difficult because many of these things are diseases that are found in farm-raised fish. It is difficult to find them impacts in the wild. I could find no incidence of White River crayfish throughout Wisconsin or Michigan or some of these other ones. The Asian tapeworm is one that is very prevalent in Michigan waters, and they're concerned about it. They don't know how it got there or that, but it's certainly a possibility that it came from Arkansas golden shiners. But we don't know what the distribution of Asian tapeworm in Minnesota is at this point either, and people have suggested that it's probably here. We just haven't been looking for it. So I could not find definite negative impacts of the introduction of these things, except possibly the Asian tapeworm, and there's less concern in Wisconsin. There's more concern in Michigan for the golden shiner virus because it does seem to have impacted muskies in hatcheries because they feed them bait fish, and these muskies appeared to have suffered mortality as a result of golden shiner virus.
One more follow-up. At this point, there's a suggestion that one of the solutions is to raise a whole lot more golden shiners within the boundaries of Minnesota. Do we have some climatic and issues with trying to farm golden shiners in this part of the Midwest?
Mr. Gunderson.
Representative, Mr. Chair, we have two significant problems facing us to raise more golden shiners. One is that production ponds are being lost through the development around them, less winter kill, Therefore, there's more bullheads and other things in there that prevent successful culture of golden shiners in these ponds. The second is climate, and I've thought about that and worked a little bit with some folks at Iowa State University that looked at trying to the golden shiners spawn late June, early July, and there's not much of a growing season for them. If we could put them into ponds in early May, we could gain 6 weeks of growing season, and it might prove to be enough to get them to market size in one season. So I think there's some opportunities for research there. We do stock sucker larvae into ponds in early May, late April, and so there may be food resources, but we'd have to, I think there's opportunity there to look to see if that might be a possibility.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this report, and I hope we keep an open mind. I may have said it in jest, but golden shiners are an important thing if you fish, and we've got an issue of cost and availability, and that industry is important. We don't want to certainly risk unnecessary, introduction of invasive species, but I think we really need to keep an open mind here and look around us. We're all Midwesterner, and I don't mean to impugn that Wisconsin is spelling me stupid as compared to Minnesota, but we need to look at this carefully. We're definitely out of step with the rest of the folks in the Midwest.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
you're welcome.
Mr. Gunderson, so I'm just asking for your opinion. What do you think is the best state in the country for sport fishing?
Mr. Gunderson.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I think I'm obligated to say Minnesota, but I truly believe it.
Representative Becker-Finn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo that in my own experience, and so I think this is perhaps one of those areas where it's okay to be different because we have different expectations as far as protecting our fish and our water here in Minnesota. And then could you just clarify how many different pathogens or invasive species were you evaluating potentially coming in with these minnows? I know you mentioned five specifically, but what was the total number?
Mr. Gunderson.
Representative, Mr. Chair, the request for proposals that I addressed that Minnesota Data put out listed 27 different organisms or groups of organisms, and during the process, several more were suggested through interaction with the University of Minnesota. So I evaluated 33 different organisms.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's important to point out that many, many destructive species have been brought in on purpose throughout history to deal with one problem or perceived problem. And, you know, as time gone on and we have more information and maybe we get a little bit smarter, we realize that we've now created a much bigger, more permanent problem by some willing behavior that we did at the beginning. So I'm happy that, you know, you were looking at that many different factors, the 33 different potential risks to our fish here. It really looks like at this point it might be, you know, kind of short-sighted to go ahead and encourage importation as far as, you know, since when did we trust Arkansas to protect our water and our fish? So I'm happy that there were 33 different things looked at. Is it also possible, Mr. Gunderson, that there are other pathogens and risks that we might not yet be aware of when it comes to what could be coming along with these shiners?
Mr. Gunderson.
Representative, Mr. Chair, there certainly is. I know I looked at one report that was looking at viruses in bait fish, and they identified the golden shiner virus, the fathead nidovirus, which is another one up that we need to, I think, take a look at in Minnesota. And then they listed several unknown viruses. And so these are unknown, but these were collected in bait fish from South Dakota, Minnesota, and Arkansas. So from the research, I could not tell where those unknown viruses were. So it could be in aquaculture. It could be in the wild harvest as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick point before my question. Not too many years ago, the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, decided that in response to the aquatic invasive issue, we would require that boats coming into the state of Minnesota would have to have a sticker displayed on the hull. And being a guy from the Brainerd Lakes area with literally dozens and dozens and dozens of resorts, may not be particularly of interest here, maybe, but to those small folks, small family-run resorts, when you impose a restriction like that, it created quite a problem. And we had people that lost literally tens and twenty thousand dollars in business over the course of a summer. The point simply is, might not be a big issue in the sense, you know, maybe across the state of Minnesota, but in areas like mine, not having access to bait is huge. And people who can't access bait will go somewhere else. And I just want to make a clarification. When you were visiting with Representative Lewick a moment ago, I thought I heard you say you could not find, and I could go back to the record and listen for myself, but maybe some context, you could not find a definite negative impact in regard to other states or maybe Minnesota. I'm not sure. So what was that? What was that statement referring to?
Mr. Gunderson.
Mr. Representative, Mr. Chair, it's very difficult to see impacts in wild populations, and I was not able to find any that occurred as a result of things like the mosquito fish or the pathogens that I mentioned or the non-native crayfish. The veterinarian in Wisconsin pointed out to me that these things don't always show up in the environment, or if they do, they may not last long. VHS virus is a very bad virus that we're concerned about. He related that in Lake Winnebago, the virus had a significant fish kill 10 years ago, and now they can't find any evidence of the virus at all. So documenting impacts is very difficult, and it doesn't mean to say that there can't be some, and you don't want you want to avoid any kind of risk to the valuable fisheries that we have here in the state. But I was just not able to see a population level impact that resulted from these importation of golden shiners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, in listening to this, I'm reminded of an old movie where they had some amber, and there was a mosquito in the amber. And they went in, and they got the blood out of the mosquito. And they had all these protocols and all the best management practices to ensure that everything would work out all right. And it didn't, because nature will find a way. And I'm not equating that you're talking about tyrannosaurs here or velociraptors, but you're actually talking about something that's more insidious that could infect lakes and destroy the economy if it was let loose. So nature will find a way, and I think having precautions and a risk-benefit analysis to really weigh that risk helps out. We have example after example where nature has found a way and has negative consequences.
Thank you. So we all agree with you, Mr. Gunderson, that Minnesota is the best state for freshwater fishing. Which lake is the best? With that, we're adjourned.